Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with John Lloyd Young. We also review On the Town and Disgraced. That plus a little bit more. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Monday, November 3rd, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and Man of the Places. Hello, Peter.
Good evening.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
With us today, we have a very special guest. John Lloyd Young is with us. Our fans and listeners will know John Lloyd Young from Jersey Boys, where he originated the part of Frankie Valli on Broadway, but also in the movie of Jersey Boys, which is coming out on DVD very soon. So, John Lloyd, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys.
So tell us, you know, having played Frankie Valli for so many years and gotten to do it on the big screen, how has the character changed for you?
Well, you know, on stage, the character Frankie Valli is the character, but he's also kind of, you know, the last man standing at the end of the stage production and your MC for the final thrust of the story. On screen, hardly any narration whatsoever. So for me, after having played it on stage so many times, to take it to the screen and make it more of a sort of a psychological profile of the man as opposed to being a stage entertainer, mm-hmm. was just a more sort of subtle acting exercise and a sort of peek into the psychological reality of this character that now all the millions of people saw the stage show feel they know. It's a different take and another sort of peek into who this man actually is. I think the movie actually gets closer to what Frankie Valli really is in real life.
I can appreciate that. Now, a few years had passed from your being on Broadway and the movie being made. When you heard the movie was being made, did you say to yourself, they're going to say Young is too old?
Actually, the span of years that that is covered in Frankie Valli's life actually made me more age appropriate for most of the character arc than before. So I wasn't worried about that, and I also stay out of the sun and drink a lot of water. So I don't have a craggy look as of yet, but I'll welcome those character lines when they come. the first thought that went through my head when they first talked about the movie was just, I hope I get a shot at it because I have some insight into this guy that sure. I really want to share.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, meeting Clint Eastwood, was that intimidating? Do we hear, oh no, he's a pussycat? What's he like?
Clint Eastwood is no pussycat, but he's also not intimidating either. In fact, just yesterday I got back from visiting with him up at his golf course in Monterey. He invited me up there to sing some songs from my album and to visit with him. And he's a friend now. And everything that you would hope that you might have from a legendary Hollywood director, which is friendship and mentorship and guidance. And the fact that I made my first major studio film with him and now have access to him as a friend in my life is really wonderful. But the feeling I have with him now is that the rapport that I established with him within the first couple days of being on his set And I felt also an instant ease with him the minute I met him. You know, I was back doing the show on Broadway after several years away from the original cast, mm-hmm. and he saw a performance. So, the minute I met him, I thought I might be doing this movie only because of the instant ease we had with each other.
How wonderful.
It's interesting what you said about, one of the differences between the show and the film. When I first saw the show, the first time I saw it, it struck me that it was very cinematic in terms of the writing. And even the narration that you referred to sort of reminded me of Goodfellas. Of course, in that case, it's voiceover, obviously. But I almost thought that that's what they would put on screen when they did it as voiceover. And so it is so interesting and ironic that you say that, that the narration, in fact, was dropped.
Well, the narration wasn't dropped across the board. It was, for those students of Jersey Boys, and there are some who've seen the show 30 times and then the movie 15, there are some people who really can, are like those people who sit in the park for Shakespeare in the Park and have a script with them and watch every mm-hmm. word. There are people who know Jersey Boys inside out, and for those who do, they will notice that the narration is pretty much retained for the other three guys who play the Four Seasons, but then somehow mysteriously drops off in the movie and Frankie doesn't really talk to you. Whereas on stage, like I said, he's the last man standing and sort of that last final dynamic thrust of narration that brings the show home in the stage version. They chose to do away with that in the movie, and Frankie is someone that you observe more than hear from. And the only time really that I talk to you on camera is at the very end in that final when everyone is tying up their story. And it's a peculiar difference from one to the next, which leaves the actor only one choice, which is to know that, like other films, you're being observed. And it's about the audience really watching you and understanding your psychology from observation. You don't really get to tell them in your own words what you're thinking.
One of the most remarkable things that I saw when going to Jersey Boys early on was the fact that during Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, you received a standing ovation during the number. I'd only seen that happen one time before, and that was for Jennifer Holliday, and I'm telling you I am not going. So my question is, did that happen at the very first preview? Did it take a while for that to happen? Do you remember?
I remember that things were really over the top and surprising right away from the minute we had audiences. Peter, you know New York theater very well, all of you do, and sometimes those first audiences of a preview of a show are often people who know theater inside and out mm-hmm. and are very theater-centric people and have seen it all. And so there can be a lot of skepticism at the beginning. What's this going to be? Is this going to be a waste of my time? And mm-hmm. there was some sort of, arms crossed and people sitting on their hands and sort of mm-hmm. scowling faces when we first started those first 2 days or so of previews. Mm-hmm. But by the time that the songs started rolling out and in the story of the show, the band, about midway through the first act, that the band started to come together and have success in the story of the show, those arms were no longer crossed and those scowls were sort of relaxing. And even those sort of really skeptical audiences that were there that first week were taken over by what they were seeing. And there's nothing, I think, like the electricity of an original cast in a show that is becoming a hit. And it was sort of a tidal wave that kind of engulfed all of us, those of us on stage and in the audience. And one of those rare moments where you really get taken away by a show that is really compelling and highly entertaining. And it happened really within the first few days of our first public performances.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, today is November 4th. It's Election Day here in the United States. And we don't really wade into politics very much, and we're not going to hear, but I heard that you were appointed to President Obama's Arts and Humanities Committee?
I was appointed a second term appointee with a new crop of appointees for the second term. And it was a committee started by Ronald Reagan years ago, and every administration has its own personality, as we know. The Obamas care very much about early education, and so the main thrust of this committee under the Obamas is early education and working with kids, making sure that the most disadvantaged schools don't neglect to use the arts as a catalyst to improve school culture and performance in all, across all subjects. So I'm actually going to the White House this weekend for one of our major meetings and some awards for national youth arts and humanities programs. And, you know, depending on the results of the election today, we'll see what the mood is like.
Yes.
Yeah, ain't that the truth.
But, you know, this is it. Let me say this, though, that education, arts education for kids is an extra political sort of thing. It's outside of politics. So no matter what happens in the elections, we're all going to be, I think, wary. It's always rewarding to engender, you know, the arts in our schools, and that's what we'll be focusing on when we get together.
It should be outside of politics, but I'm afraid it's not. I mean,
we are working hard to make those arguments in ways that are not just made with words, but that people, our opposition, in ways that they feel, because those are the most convincing arguments are when you feel that you must do something in a certain way. And so we're trying to find we're trying to get to the hearts of our opponents.
John Lloyd, you are from Sacramento, correct?
I was born in Sacramento, but my upbringing was on the East Coast.
Was on the East Coast. And so let's talk about your arts and education. You went to Brown University. What was your experience at Brown like? It seems to me, although I could be incorrect, that Brown doesn't have a huge musical theater program, but you were studying acting there, weren't you?
Yes, and Brown has a very active student community, and if you think about a personality of a school, people there are real self-starters and kind of iconoclastic. But very passionate, and certainly the group of people that I was there with were, and every subsequent group that I've observed, they always seem to be. But my group was really Sondheim-centric, and I think we did two student productions a year over 4 years. Six of those eight productions were Sondheim. Uh-huh.
Wow. That's great. I love that.
Really, really. I mean, and I'll tell you, Sondheim is intricate on both an acting level and a music level. You have to be a very adept musician to handle Sondheim, and also have to be a very subtle and talented actor. And so, six shows over 4 years of Stephen Sondheim was pretty great training for whatever was to come later, mm-hmm. whether it be acting or singing.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine you're really looking forward to the film of Into the Woods.
I can't wait to see what they do with it. This is one of the things that when you do this, you know, and if an actor is ever in the lucky position of originating something on Broadway that becomes a hit, which I was, then you have of course a vested interest in seeing what's going to happen when they take a hit or a famous Broadway show and make it into a movie. And in this case of Jersey Boys, being able to be in it was of course amazing and how I wanted things to go, but I still would have been very interested in seeing what they did with it if I hadn't been in it.
Sure.
So to bring us back before Brown, what kind of education did you get in the in theater and music and the various arts when you were younger? Do you have family that's in the business, or how did you end up in the business?
I was in a military family, and one of the things that was sort of a grounding thing, mechanism for me, so I didn't get lost in the shuffle between all the moves, was this interest in the arts and interest in theater, interest in singing, so that wherever we went, whatever community we ended up in, I could find a theater company there or a choir or whatever and get involved and could sort of continue that artistic through line that was a real comfort for me through all of that instability that you have as a kid moving around in a military family. So for me, it was really jumping into the community and school theater and music programs wherever I happened to be. One of those places that was probably one of the most formative was, of all places, and anyone who knows this place would not be surprised, but you guys might not know that Omaha, Nebraska is a really thriving arts community. They have one of the best community theaters in the country, the Omaha Community Playhouse.
Sure.
They also had a children's theater at that time, and so this was semi-professional or professional-level theater that I was involved in for pretty much 4 years straight at those formative years, you know, the Tom Sawyer years when you're 10, 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I was deeply passionate about it. I was involved in stage makeup and choir and music and all of these things. And, really kind of helped me to find an identity and a direction of where I would like to go. And, you know, I was that kid that when all the other kids were like trading baseball cards, I was making up the neighborhood children into like ghouls and, you know, playing with stage makeup or listening to like the original cast recording of Chorus Line on my Walkman, you know? So I was that kid that had his mentality was in New York City, even though I was living in the heart of the Midwest. And kept that passion sort of throughout my whole life, so that when I graduated college, it was sort of, there was sort of no question where I would go and what I would pursue.
Well, as Walter Kerr said about Sandy Dennison, any Wednesday there should be one of you in every home.
I think there probably is. You know what's so great now is that, when I was coming up, there was no internet. There wasn't this sort of accessible at any moment from wherever you were community of people who loved theater. So for me, it was reading books that were probably edited by you, Peter, from the public library, and listening to cast albums on vinyl. I mean, I was at the cusp. I'm that generation that was at the cusp of, you know, I started high school drafting my papers on legal pads, and by the end of college was writing everything on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bridged that. Sort of, we're like the generation that bridges the bricks and mortar business model with the computer business model. And we kind of have a foot in both worlds. And but I, all of my interest in the theater and in the performing arts as a kid was through public libraries and books and cast albums and then the occasional trip to New York to actually see the real thing.
So let's talk a little bit about the making of the movie. Had you had much experience in film before making Jersey Boys the movie?
I did this romping family comedy like the Mambo Italiano, the gay Mambo Italiano, or the Jewish Mambo Italiano called Oy Vey, My Son is Gay, which was shelved immediately. But I did this movie. I was really excited about it. It was a comedy, and I was ironically, because the character was gay, I was the straight man in the comedy. Everyone else was crazy around me, and I was the sane one. And I was the son, and Lainey Kazan was my mother, and
yes.
Saul Rubinek was my father. And essentially, it's a comedy of errors of these. It's sort of a throwback movie to the 80s. It felt like an 80s movie in some ways. But, you know, I believe that there are people who are on the vanguard of things like gay rights, and then there are laggards. And this movie is for everyone who has not caught up. And I have that same mentality when it comes to, my work on the President's Committee. Sometimes I find myself making an argument that to people like us would seem pretty simplistic, but I really just don't believe in sitting around and preaching to the choir. I would rather touch people who are lagging a little bit or, may not think about the arts on a daily basis, but could maybe be reminded about why it might be important to them, and you have to find a way to articulate that. Anyway, I did this movie, which is sort of a throwback movie, and then it got shelved. It just didn't get distribution. It was when everything, hit the fan, in like 2009, and nothing was getting distribution, and so it sat on a shelf for years. And then I did Jersey Boys, and voila, Now the movie's available on DVD everywhere. The other movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a lead, and it was with Lainey Kazan. It was an exciting experience. It happened right after I moved to LA, so, you know, got started right away with something. And it was a sweet movie, nice movie, good respectable first movie. I knew what movie making was by the time I got to Clint.
The reason that I asked that was that, I've never worked with Clint Eastwood, but I read that he's very swift in his movie shooting and that there's not a ton of rehearsal and there's not a ton of takes. So you kind of have to nail it. But given that most of the folks that were on the screen there had done, you know, some version of Jersey Boys for many, many performances, you guys probably did nail it quickly. But what was it like for you? Was it a whirlwind? Did you shoot in sequence? Did you shoot out of sequence? How did it go for you?
I don't think it's possible to shoot any movie in sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be something like shooting something that's actually happening on a stage in real time.
Yeah.
Because it's just way too cost prohibitive to do that. So no, we shot completely out of sequence. There were days when I started the day in age makeup, and the last scene of the day I was 16, I'm grateful that the script was very close to what we did on stage, because otherwise I probably would have needed some sort of a chart to figure out where am I in the age of this character and going on, so that to remind myself. But what I had was in my head, like the chart of, and having been back on Broadway right before that to remind myself of the arc of the show. Mm. When I found on one day that I was playing Frankie at 45 and then playing him at 16 and then playing him at 25, then in all within the same day, I was able to, in my mind, go back and reference, where am I in the stage show at this point? What have I done to modify my voice, to bring some more maturity to my voice or less maturity to my voice or whatever in the aging process, and all of that sort of stuff. I looked back at the stage experience as a blueprint for where am I supposed to be today in this scene and in this moment.
You know, it's interesting. I know Peter is very much into lists and facts and figures. I don't know if you've ever done this one, Peter, but here's one for you.
Yeah.
How many people total recreated a stage role on film? I think it would probably be an extremely small percentage if you considered all of the roles in all of the film.
Yeah, would have to be.
And some occasional films skewed it, like Damn Yankees and
Pajama
Game. Yeah, okay. But I'm not talking just about musicals either. Mm-hmm. That would be. I think it's fair to say that John Lloyd is in extremely elite company in that regard.
I agree.
I'm not unaware of that, and I. You know, it's funny because the first time I ever met Peter Felicia, I can't speak for you, Peter, but I felt an instant affinity because as an Ivy League guy, and I was a teaching assistant in this big survey of the American musical theater. My segment was Candor and Ebb, and mm-hmm. Peter and I have a lot of, like, we know a lot of the trivial knowledge you're an actual historian, but I'm sort of an amateur historian of the theater. And all the things that seemed to get Peter going were also things that privately got me going, all those facts and figures and lists. And so I was very, very aware of, if I were able to get to the movie, where that would fit into history and how rare it was. And I just have to say that as a kid who was growing up seeing Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady or Joel Grey in Cabaret or Yul Brynner in The King and I, these movies of Broadway shows that I was too young or not even alive and there to see them, the fact that I could see Robert Preston in The Music Man and get a sense of what my grandmother, who saw him on Broadway, was, you know, she raved about that for years and years, her whole life. She'd rave about these performances she saw on stage that I could never see. That was my one artifact and one clue to what it might have been like to see Robert Preston on stage. And so, you know, when Jersey Boys became a big hit and then the movie was talked about, which was actually right away, they started talking about the movie. So it's been several years that I've been aware that the movie would happen or could happen. I really wanted to do it for my sake, because I understand where that falls into history, but also for the sake of some 15-year-old who's 15 now, who never saw me on Broadway and probably never will see me play that role, but gets a sense for, you know, if their parents saw the original cast of Jersey Boys, they get a taste for what that might have been, because they see it sort of in a different sense, of course, as we all know. But it's still me in the movie, and there's still the essence of what I did on Broadway is still present in that movie, and I'm just glad for posterity that I was able to do it.
We're taking up a lot of your time, but before you run, can you tell us about that great segment of the closing credits on the movie?
You mean Clint Eastwood's only career Bollywood ending?
So far.
Well, I have to tell you.
American Sniper is about to come out. We'll see if it would Bradley Cooper do in advance and Fallujah.
Of course.
Well, I think that the closing credits might sell a lot of DVDs, because it was such an exciting thing to see. Everybody come back, and it was a big production number, a big old Hollywood ending, which was really a Broadway ending.
And a curtain call, too.
Well, Clint saw the stage productions when he got attached to the project. He went around and saw the productions, and he recognized, just as you guys probably would, that one of the exciting things about the stage productions, the stage production of Jersey Boys, is that all of these actors who have played these characters throughout the show for you come back in sort of this fantasy ending and tie it all up, and that the effect that it has on the audience is that they'd like it to start all over again from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, it's a very, we're used to it in the theater, bringing back all the actors, and we all know that they're the actors and this is a big finale, right? But that's very unique for a screen. And the idea that all of us would come back for a final number at the end, ignoring the fact that that some of the characters had broken up, or some people had left the story or whatever, bring us all back again together with an acknowledgement that we're performers who just did this movie for you, and here we are saying goodbye sort of as the actors and the characters at once in this fantasy number is just, I think, unique, especially because the movie that precedes it is such a Clint Eastwood movie. It's not your typical movie musical in any way, tonally or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it says sort of, a wink to the stage productions that clearly have been successful all over the world now. And it's something for both the fans of the stage productions and now literally millions of people whose only exposure to Jersey Boys will be this movie. And they'll get a taste in that last number of what the stage phenomenon has been and is.
Well, John, this has been incredibly generous of you to spend so much time with us chatting about the movie. If we wanted to hang out with you on New Year's Eve, what could we hang out with you on New Year's Eve this year?
You'd have to come to Feinstein's at Nico's, where I'm playing on New Year's Eve in San Francisco. You want to come to San Francisco and hang out with me there?
Well, it's funny because we've been talking about the Feinstein's in San Francisco, and I don't think any of us have been out there and seen it, but yeah, it was launched, and we were talking about how we have to get out there and see it, and to see that you're going to be there at 7:30 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. on New Year's Eve this year, I would hope that anybody listening to this who is anywhere near San Francisco can get to see your show. That would be awesome.
Well, thanks for the plug. It's going to be a fun night, and I have to say I've never rung in the new year in San Francisco. It'll be my first time in that city, so I'm looking forward to it.
Great.
Oh, that's great. I want to remind our listeners that Jersey Boys is now available on HD and will be available on Blu-ray and DVD on November 11th. Please run out to Amazon or your Where would you actually get it in person? Maybe Target or
please,
Walmart
please,
or something.
All of
like
them.
That.
Best Buy and Walmart.
Best Buy, Walmart.
Target
exactly.
Will be everywhere.
And the walls in Jersey. And you can
certainly hope so.
Pick it up, and you can pick it up there. John Lloyd Young, thank you so much. People can catch up with John Lloyd Young on Facebook at John Lloyd Young Friends. So search him out on Facebook. And thanks so much.
Goodbye.
Talk to you guys. Hello to all of our mutual friends back in
London. Yes, and please come back and do a big old Broadway show for us when you have the moment.
As soon as it comes together, I'll be there.
Good. Thank you.
Till then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we have a lot to catch up on. On the Town opened up at the Lyric Theater on October 16th, and Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Sure. On the Town, I saw the Broadway revival in 1971 with Bernadette Peters and Phyllis Newman, and I certainly saw the last revival. It wasn't all that long ago. And given the fact that both of those hadn't done very well, I wasn't terribly optimistic about this one doing well either, and there was much consternation about the fact that they were going to be in the Lyric Theater, which used to be the Hilton Theater, which used to be the Foxwood Theater, which used to be the Ford Theater, setting a record, I'm sure, for the number of names the theater has had in, what, about 16 years. But it's a big place, yeah. I have to admit, I was sitting reasonably close, and so I may not be the best person to say how it really plays in the far reaches of the back of the orchestra, but I thought it was swell. I had a wonderful time at it, and I was very surprised that I was as enthusiastic as I was. Of course, I did know that there was going to be this wonderful, wonderful sound from the orchestra, which has quite a few pieces in it, quite a few more than we're usually used to, so that was really great. But you really need young people in these roles, and that's what they have here. Certainly, Tony Yazbek, who in a very short period of time has really distinguished himself tremendously. This is not the first time I've seen him play Gaby. And you say, oh, you went to Barrington? No, I didn't. He went to CCM and played it there. So it was very nice to see him all these years later doing it, perhaps more age appropriate now than he was back then when he was 17 or 18. So that was fun. And he's very, very good, and certainly his voice is quite wonderful as well. I was very, very taken with the new interpretation of these guys being sexual. It was refreshing to see that. I think that was a wise move to make them a little more randy than usual. But one thing I had heard all along that people were really objecting to is when they saw one of the guys in his underwear that he had an American flag on the back of the underwear. And I was hearing this right up virtually till showtime. I'm glad to say that that flag has been taken off the underwear. So because really, I mean, people were more patriotic then, and that wouldn't have happened. That didn't happen until the 60s when people started playing around with the American flag. So so that was nice to see eliminated. Alicia Humphreys, it's a funny name, and she's funny as Hildy. She's a Zoftig girl, and she really has a wonderful comic sense. I enjoyed her immeasurably when she did I Can Cook Too, because she really did cook while she was doing it. No question about that. So she was a very nice surprise to me. Jay Armstrong Johnson playing Chip really had the comic touch too when they both were in the taxi cab together and singing Come Up to My Place. Well, of course, it's Alicia who's singing Come Up to My Place rather than Chip, who's more interested in seeing what's going on around town. Philip Boykin doesn't have much to do, but he starts us off very well because he has this wonderful basso profundo voice and playing the workman who has those wonderful low notes when he talks about how he's not out of bed yet. So he gets us off to a very nice start. You know it's going to be something special there. And Megan Fairchild making her Broadway debut as Ivy. the girl of Gaby's dreams. He sees her picture on the subway. She's that Miss Turnstiles, Miss Subways, something that used to happen here in New York. They used to pick an arbitrary young woman and feature her for a month. And he sees her picture. And one of the things that's always been hard for me to believe is he takes the picture down and a woman chases him endlessly through the city, you know. And I've always thought, at least if she could say that was my granddaughter, you know, that would give more motivation for
idea.
That to happen. I think it is, you know. So now that little old lady is played by Jackie Hoffman, who also plays Madame Dilly, who is the voice teacher of Ivy Smith. And it's very clear that the reason she wants Ivy to keep taking voice lessons is because she needs the money, and she probably needs it for drink because she is not above taking a swig out of her little flask every now and then. I had heard a lot of bad things about Jackie Hoffman, I have to tell you. People saying she was over the top and all that. I thought she was fine. I understand over the top, but I think that she definitely did with the roles because she also played other roles as well. She was the nightclub singer in the sequence where they go and to various clubs, and the same song is being played at every club because, you know, it's the popular song of the day. And she winds up doing it. I thought she was quite fine. It was a treat to see her again. I guess I'm a fan, you know. Clyde Alvis is Ozzy, the sailor who gets attracted to, and Claire de Lune. Needless to say, this is not a realistic musical with somebody named Claire de Lune or her boyfriend Pitkin T. Bridgework. You know, I mean, it was a different time, no question. I was saying the other day, I think The Clock would make a good musical, if you know that Judy Garland movie, when she doesn't sing, and somebody said, no, it'd be too much like On the Town. And I said, no, it's more realistic than that. You know, I mean, so this is a fanciful thing. I wish that Beowulf Borat, a designer I admire greatly, had given a bit more detail of what the city looked like back then. He has just very perfunctory buildings that are projected as they go through town, and they're simply blue monoliths. That's all they are. And what a treat it would have been to have seen projections of the way the city looked back then. I think that would have really made a big difference in how this works. I haven't talked about Elizabeth Stanley as Claire de Lune. Yes, she's fine too. Really, they're young kids. They're having a wonderful time up there. We do too. I also want to mention Michael Rupert, the senior member of the group who plays Pitkin T. Bridgework, who gets one song to himself in which he talks about the fact that all through his life he has understood when things have not gone his way, and now he's going to stop doing that. It's a song that advances the action too, which didn't happen that often in the early 40s. So he does that, and he does it very well. And so altogether, it's very enjoyable. I'm not sure that they're home free, to be perfectly frank with you. For one thing, revivals, Chicago and Cabaret excluded, don't tend to run as long as the originals, and the original ran a little over a year. Yeah, and again, I don't know what it looks like from what must be the second balcony, and what feels like the second balcony, and you know, it's a freewheeling show. I mean, the moment when it all comes together, of course, is that one of the most beautiful songs ever written in the history of musical theater, Some Other Time, when they realize that now these boys are going away, and they're going to be going to war. And we'll catch up some other time turns out to be a euphemism, because they're not sure they're going to catch up some other time. It's also very poignant when they get on the ship, the three other sailors come down the gangplank. It's their turn now. Well, I guess it's our turn to see On the Town if you want to see it. But I do believe of the three revivals, this is definitely the one that's the best.
All right. Michael, what did you think about it?
I could go on and on, but let me just say I agree with everything Peter said. The night I saw the show, I was conscious that the audience was with it from the first moment. When Philip Boykin got up on stage and from the audience, by the way, and saying, I feel like I'm not out of bed yet. In fact, the audience, there was a kind of like affectionate laughter. And it's not even really, I don't think it's an especially funny line. I guess it's somewhat amusing because that he goes down to these big bass notes and he sings, I feel like I'm not out of bed yet. And so it's kind of cute, you know, but it's not like necessarily funny. But the audience was so ready to have a great time, and the show did not disappoint them. As Peter mentioned, many people were concerned that it was playing this huge barn, but it is a very broad show to begin with in terms of its humor, and so I think that the John Rando's direction was absolutely for almost 100% pitch perfect for the size of the theater and also for the style of the show. I should mention that the book has been very judiciously punched up by Robert Carey and Jonathan Tolens. There are some lines in the original that are just not that funny, especially I'm thinking of this kind of repeated dialogue that happens between these two women on the subway about Mr. Godolphin is the name that keeps coming up. And it's the same basic kind of talk, but they just sharpen the jokes a little bit and put like a couple of punchlines in there. One or two of Hildy's lines I noticed was punched up just a little bit. I'm always very wary of that kind of thing, but really in this case, I think they did it just enough to really help without betraying Comden and Green. So I'm really, as Peter says, my hat off is off to those two, because it's not easy to do that. And in fact, another show I think is going to come up later in this podcast where I feel that the revision was not successful. But this, it really doesn't even qualify as a revision so much, just slight punching up. The cast is absolutely superb, as Peter said. Those three guys, for what it's worth, are not quite as young as they seem, but there is so much energy and talent among the three of them that it's, you know, they might as well be 18, really, which I guess is what they're supposed to be, like late teens, early 20s. The only one that I thought the night I saw it, I have to say, and I've loved her and everything else, but to me, Elizabeth Stanley was pushing a little too much, to the point where actually she was singing off pitch sometimes because she was doing all this stuff. And I guess some of that is the actual direction, but I thought she just went a little too far, especially also because her character is supposed to be, start out anyway as sort of a kind of, stick in the mud to some extent. You know, she's this lady anthropologist and she's, but it turns out that she's got this tremendous sex drive. That's the joke of her. But yes, Jackie Hoffman, I thought was also perfectly in pitch with the direction and the show and the size of the theater. I thought it was hilarious that she wore the same glasses for all of her numbers in the nightclub. And I agree also about the set. I suppose that was just a decision that they made. And one thing I will say is that in the Come Up to My Place number, although I would have also, Peter, I had the same exact thought as you do. It would have been great to see the city as it was back then. But I think it might have been a little more distracting from the song. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did that on purpose. Let's not fail to mention Stephen DeRosa, because he also shines in some little roles, and also Allison Gwynn, who plays Lucy Schmieler, the roommate of Hildy. So I wish this show the absolute best. I was so thrilled by it, and I do hope that they. Wouldn't that be something if it's a hit in that huge theater, a show that was, as you know, I don't know if Peter actually said this, but the last two revivals were extremely short-lived. People maybe thought that the show was its time was past, whatever. But I really think it's not. And that score and that orchestra and the choreography by the choreography by Joshua Bergasse, which
I forgot,
which has as I think some people have pointed out, it's almost entirely his own, because apparently little, if any, of the Jerome Robbins choreography survived. And in fact, he had to consult with people and kind of sort of struggled from his own memory to recreate what little of it they did in Jerome Robbins' Broadway. So Joshua Bergasse, really, just bravo! It's amazing, and it's also well performed by an incredible ensemble, and I just love the show, and I hope it's here for a long time.
Did you guys think that the previous revival, now 16 years ago in 98, what did you think of that revival?
Well, I saw it both in the park and then when it moved to Broadway, and I thought that in the park it had its own kind of magic to some extent, I guess, because it was in the park. I do remember that it wasn't especially funny. They didn't really get the humor. That was with no punching up, so maybe that was part of it. And also, do you remember? I don't remember the details, but there was a change in choreographer, from the park to Broadway, because people were thinking that was what was wrong with it and what needed to be fixed. But I'm not sure that was necessarily true. And at any rate, it didn't help. And that show was a tremendous blow to the public theater, as I understand it, because they financed it to a very large degree, and I think it took them years to recover from that tremendous loss.
Well, it's true. There was real magic in the park, just being there. The setting, yes. I think that's what seduced so many people, saying, oh, we've got to move it. But without that wonderful New York backdrop behind us, it really did make a big difference. You really felt confined and in a way, even though they were at a big theater too, but still not as big as this one. But yeah, they painted on a broad canvas here and they made it work. I'm very embarrassed I didn't mention the choreography, because the show is very famous for its choreography, not just because of Jerome Robbins doing it, but also that it was essentially based on a ballet they had done called Fancy Free. And I don't know about you, Michael, but when I bought the album to Fancy Free, I expected to hear a lot of On the Town. Not a note. Well, obviously there are notes, but I mean, there's not one melody in Fancy Free that wound up in On the Town. So we started from scratch there and certainly came up with wonderful stuff. As much as I love Some of the Time, I also have to go to bat for Lucky to Be Me, which I think is really a glorious song as well. So, and Tony Yazbek does that to good advantage as well. So,
and the 98 revival had a young Jesse Tyler Ferguson in his Broadway debut.
Right. Now very famous.
Did he have a Theater World Award that season?
No, but I think he did win for the Most Fabulous Story Ever Told.
Oh, yeah.
That rings a bell to me. And then I may be wrong about that, but I think that rings a bell.
Leah Delaria as a very different Hildy, right?
Very different, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move forward. The three of us got a chance to see Disgraced at the Lyceum. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Disgraced?
Oh, well, I had very, very mixed feelings about it. I had not seen it at Lincoln Center at the Clairetot Theater. And it has since won the Pulitzer. So I guess that's a large reason why I came to Broadway. I liked a lot of it, but I also had the feeling I have so often is that when people write about race and racial conflict and things like that, it's very easy to make an effect, and sometimes it's easy to push buttons, but I don't necessarily know if the quality of this is equal to what I don't agree that it's equal to what everyone else seems to think it is. It's by Ayad Akhtar, and it's about this fellow named Amir, who is I guess there's some question for a while about exactly what his nationality is, but he eventually says Pakistani. And he at the beginning of the play is pretty much a master of the universe, to use that that phrase that used to be used. He's very, very white collar. He they mention how much his shirts cost, I think, $600 each.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, he seems to have it all, but then everything unravels quite quickly. The other roles are, his wife is Gretchen Mol, playing his wife, Emily. And then they have, their friend, Isaac, played by Josh Radnor, and his wife Jory, played by Karen Pittman. And then there's the other character is Abe, who is he's a nephew, is that right, Peter?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, of Amir. So, and that's played by Danny Ashok. Did I say that? But I don't know. There were things. There were a couple of things I noted that really took me out of the show. At one point, early on, things are going pretty well. Things haven't started to unravel yet. And Amir starts telling the story about how he knew a girl, a Jewish girl, when he was a kid in school. And I guess he didn't realize that she was Jewish and that he was supposed to hate her for that reason. And then his mother said something negative about negative about the girl because she was Jewish. And then Amir tells how he went back to school and spit in the girl's face. And as you might imagine, the audience kind of gasps when he says mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. But his wife says, "Oh, you know, that's terrible." And whoever else is on stage, they pause for maybe 3 seconds, and then they go on to talk about something else. And I thought, really? would they not have a much stronger reaction to that? So that was the first thing that really struck me, is what's going on here? Then everything unravels during a dinner party. I'm sorry to say. I mean, a dinner party from hell, as it turns out. And at one point, the Josh Radnor character is talking. He's going on about something, and again, it's starting to become a slightly heated discussion as they get into areas about nationality and race and things like that. But it hasn't gotten that bad yet. And at one point, Josh Radnor says to Harry Dillon's character, Amir, that he is self-loathing. And I just think that's not something that you would say to someone at a dinner party in their home, unless perhaps it was going to be your exit line. But no, they keep having dinner. And it reminds me of several things that happened in Clybourne Park. I just think it's so easy to push buttons in a play about race, and I think that there was too much of that in this play. And it's unfortunate, because I do think there were many passages of it that really were very worthy and much more complicated and less button pushing. So I was just surprised, though, that there were those moments that really kind of leapt out at me as this would really not be how people would react in situations like that.
All right. Peter, what did you think about it?
My first note on my playbill as it started to unfold was, this is God of Carnage light. and my final note was, this is God of Carnage heavy. Because it starts out a little more genteel than God of Carnage, and there doesn't seem to be as much at stake, because, of course, in God of Carnage, the two couples are arguing about their children, and parents get very proprietary and have a hard time believing their kids do anything wrong. Kids are not the issue here. Yes, it is race, and yes, it is very convenient that we have people of different races in this room, but it gets very, very ugly, and it gets ugly very quickly. And frankly, I believed it. I had no problem buying the play at all. I believe that as Avenue Q taught us, or at least told us, everyone's a little bit racist. And this play indicates that people start off being a little bit racist, and once the fire is lit, it's very hard to put out. So, yes, and in fact, when you say, Michael, that he's a master of the universe, well, not quite. It looks like he's going to be, and that's part of the play as well, that he expects he's going to be a master of the universe in no time. And unfortunately, just a happenstance thing that happened that was reported by a reporter that really didn't have as much validity, but the way the reporter phrased it has really going to impact this man's career. Mm-hmm. A chance remark, a chance phrase the reporter did, and the reporter wasn't looking for trouble or anything like that. It's just the way he put it that suddenly it put a bug in his employer's heads, and they're saying,
Well, not only that, but he, yes, it's not only the phrase, but that he, the reporter sort of implies that, that Amir represents, this group, just by the way he mentions it in the context of that quote, and that is what that's what I understood to be.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. There's no question that that's what's going on. But it's very unfortunate that this happened, because this man is now going to be victimized by this situation that he did not expect to have happen. One of the things that the play deals with is that many of us are very hysterical over the Muslim situation, and whether or not we have enough cause to feel that is another topic entirely, and that's something the play deals with as well. Should this man totally deny his Muslim roots because that's who he is? Well, we can understand why he'd like to keep it quiet. He has found a way to make it seem like he came from a different country, and it's more a lie of omission than a genuine lie. Who's really courageous under circumstances like this? You know, and I think all of us at times have felt that we've been victimized by our backgrounds, in one way or another. I mean, I even know WASPs who feel they've been victimized by their backgrounds. So I think we can relate to this play for that reason. And I think it's very strong. I'm not surprised it won the Pulitzer at all. And I think it's a worthy play. It doesn't take very long, by the way, not even 90 minutes, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it is very well performed, as Michael said. And a character that comes in early, you really think isn't going to come in again, and you start wondering why he was there in the first place. Oh, the playwright's got an answer for that, too. Don't worry about it. He'll certainly do that. But it gets very, very ugly, not only verbally. I'll say no more about that, but I think this play's going to have a hard time of it. I don't think it's what people want to see when they go out for a night on the town. Of course, there have been plenty of plays throughout history that fit that description as well, be they Streetcar or Death of a Salesman. But this one really gets under the skin, and I'm proud that they brought it to Broadway. In an ideal world, this should be on Broadway, but I think its commercial chances are very dim because it tells the truth, and people
also
want to hear it.
And the thing that you're not mentioning, which I didn't mention either, which is, you know, arguably the biggest button pusher of all.
Sure, sure.
We just can't talk about it.
So I saw it, and I was riveted by it. And I don't think that we've mentioned Hari Dillon's name, did we?
Yeah, I did.
You did? Who plays Amir. I thought that he was just really, really outstanding.
I agree.
I agree with what you're saying, Peter, is that it's really important to have a show like this on Broadway, and I don't know how they're going to make money on it.
Yeah.
it's a tough thing to sell, and...
I don't suspect it was there with the intention of making
right.
It.
Nobody rubs his hand and says we're going to make a fortune. Right. There's no question about that.
I assume that a large motivation was Tony Award eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so too. And But it also crossed my mind that this might be a very interesting movie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, on the other hand, I don't think God of Carnage did well, and because movie critics love to have that knee-jerk reaction. It's just a filmed play. They didn't open it up, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the fact whether or not the work is quality takes a real back seat to the fact that it's not cinematic. And I don't know how much cinematic stuff they could put in here. I guess we could leave. I guess we could find scenes outside. But I wish we were in a situation as we were in the 30s where nobody was bothered by that. If the dialogue was good, that was enough. Yeah, and because plenty of Broadway properties, I mean, plays that lasted a month got filmed back in those days, and nobody was really complaining about they're not opened up. You know, and it should be a given that if it's a play that's going to be in one set, let's have a film of it so that people can see it. The important thing is the message. The important thing are the words. So let's not worry about the fact that it isn't cinematic. You know, the greater good is that the work be preserved.
But also, Peter, it does occur to me just thinking, you know, off the top of my head, that there it would be much easier to open this one up, quote unquote, because there's the event. First of all, there's the event that the reporter reports on. Mm-hmm. Then there's a lot of talk about what happens at Amir's job, and just a lot of other things that are referred to. So I think it could be opened up quite easily without betraying the play in any way.
And I guarantee you that when that happened, they would still say it was too stage bound.
Oh, well, I can't say.
Yeah. Car chase. Needs a car chase.
Right.
So blow up some buildings, car chase, things like that. We're good to go. All right, so let's wrap it up. I'd like to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and you can get streamed directly to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found on BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about this evening. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. Long last love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. Trust in me when I say